Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund, and hey, parents don't know everything, as this woman will attest.
That was something I just had to teach myself.
That's Tiffany Leungren with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Tiffany says her mom brought her up just fine, but neglected to give her some crucial economic information. Listen again.
That was something I just had to teach myself.
So here's a quiz. What info did Tiffany have to seek on her own? Was it A, how to operate a computer? Parents with analog backgrounds find it kind of tough to help kids in this digital age. Or did Tiffany have to learn B, estate planning? Her mom's will was a mess. Or did Tiffany lack knowledge of C, basic personal finance? Her mom didn't have much money, so she never talked about it. Stumped? We've got plenty to teach you. Like the answer. It's up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
Verizon, Sprint, Singular, Viglund? Yes, we're branding our own phones. I'm Tess Viglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at thriveq.com.
Give me a call on my cell phone, and this is how it summons me. Yes, that's the Pachelbel Canon. We've all heard of personal ringtones, but what about a personal cell phone? The research firm iSupply estimates by the end of the year, cell phone subscribers will reach 3 billion. Want a piece of that? Well, a new company lets you set up your own cell phone brand. Here's Marketplace's Jill Barshe.
Think you can design a better cell phone? Well, here's your chance.
The smallest groups we cater to are one person large.
That's Juha Christensen. He started a new company called Synopia. It allows anyone to become a cell phone operator with the click of a mouse.
You could sign up as yourself, start recruiting other members of your family, friends, and gradually build out your network.
Synopia sends you and all your subscribers a phone labeled with your brand name.
Much like if you have a credit card with a sports team and the bill, you know, displays the name of the sports team, when you get a Synopia bill, it actually has the name of the affinity organization that you signed up with.
Subscribers may think they're paying you, but they're actually sending their checks to Synopia. Synopia also handles customer service. More than 1,000 groups have signed up.
Yoga Phone, there's Mobile Swami, you name it.
Johannes Fislinger set up Yoga Phone through Synopia. He thinks he'll attract hordes of yogis with some extras you don't get in an ordinary cell phone. Pictures of yoga postures like Downward Dog.
And it has features like, having motivational messages that come to you, you know. So when you're under stress, you read it, take a deep breath. You know, and you relax. It's part of bringing something positive to you right where you are at this moment.
Fislinger goes into verbal contortions to explain how noisy cell phones and yoga aren't in contradiction.
Is it okay if you have your yoga phone on during yoga class?
I don't think so. I think you should not. Maybe on silent.
But the phone is not a laughing matter. It's real business. For the customer, the monthly plans echo the ones you can get through Verizon Wireless, like $39.95 for 450 minutes. That's because behind the scenes, it is Verizon Wireless. Synopia pays to use Verizon's cell phone network. And it's the latest example of a non-cell phone company that's jumped into the mobile business. They're all borrowing mobile networks from established telecom companies. Take Helio, Virgin, Disney Mobile. There are more than 100 of these brands. The biggest risk for a consumer is that these non-cell phone companies will go out of business. Weston Hendricks studies the wireless industry for Current Analysis. That's a market research firm.
If you put $200 into a phone and then they stop operating 3 or 4 months down, you know, that cost is essentially sunk for you. So you can go to another carrier, but, you know, 99% of the time you're probably not going to be able to use the same device.
That's what happened to mobile ESPN customers when Disney pulled the plug on that service last year. Hendrick expects lots of these companies to go out of business in the next year or so.
You're always taking a risk when you're one of the first subscribers with some new company.
Like slow customer service or glitches in setting up the phone. And what if YogaPhone or one of these teeny tiny cell phone companies shuts down? If you find another mini group you like under the Sinopia umbrella, you can switch free of charge. In Los Angeles, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace Money.
Today we turn the page for Chapter 2 of our financial fairy tale. Our hero and heroine, Michael Fox and Tiffany Leungren, will tie the knot on September 1st. We're following them as they walk toward the aisle to have and to hold through sickness, health, and revolving credit card debt. We're back in the kingdom of Encinitas, California, to find out how and where Tiffany and Mike developed their money sense. At their suggestion, we hit the sand.
We're at Moonlight Beach in Encinitas. When I was a kid, my mom would take us to the beach all day long. We'd sit here, play in the sand, swim. Maybe she'd drop, 50 cents on a popsicle, and we'd be completely ecstatic. We still come to the beach and take walks every once in a while. And
it's free.
In fact, free was the operative word for both Tiffany and Mike growing up.
My mom was a single mother for a good portion of my childhood and didn't really ever talk about money. I knew that we didn't have a lot of money, but I never felt like I was poor, although I know that we did. We used to get the big block of government cheese for a while, I remember that. But my mom was a very hard worker. She always had at least two jobs and provided us with what we needed. On the other hand, because she didn't talk to me about money very often, that was something I just had to teach myself as I got older.
How about you, Mike?
I was never really taught anything. I learned by example.
Whose example?
My father, Henry. He tends to pay with cash, uses credit cards very sparingly. He's always taught me that if you don't have the money, then you shouldn't be spending it.
Did your parents' management of their money or lack thereof have any effect on how you've decided to handle your finances as a couple?
I think we definitely communicate more about money than I communicated with my parents about money. I know that when we do have children, talking to them about money and showing them the ins and outs of saving and credit is going to be something that's priority.
How about you, Mike?
I can't say that it's a huge part of the way I manage my money. I actually think it's from my business. I guess that's pushed me to be more in charge of the finances in our relationship. The other day we sat down, actually, and I said, okay, what are your expenses every month? And I just got in Excel, just listed all the expenses that we have for the month.
What was that exercise like for you, Tiffany?
Well, I think I've mentioned before that I'm an independent woman and I don't like to rely on a man to handle my finances, but I think I've sort of changed my philosophy and realized that we're now a team. To have someone else take control and work all of that out, especially someone who's a little bit more numbers-oriented than I am, is a relief. So couples, I think, should be aware of what each other is spending just so they know if they're on the same page. I mean, that seems crucial to me.
When you look down the line and you have said that you want children, what discussions have you had about where you want to be financially before you start that process?
Dog comes first.
I think that nobody is ever ready to have kids. You can say I'm ready emotionally, but as far as financially, no one knows what to expect. And I think that Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, sweetie, but he seems to think that we should have this huge amount set aside. And
let's just say I disagree with her opinion.
How much would you like to have set aside, Mike?
I haven't got a number to tell you. I think that you're never really emotionally ready because you've never dealt with something like that. But I'm really pushing for a Labrador first. So I'm going to maybe work out those finances first, how much a 120-pound dog takes up in food, and then figure out a child and,
I think they're slightly different. Can I add something about a question you asked earlier? I think growing up with little means to buy the things that little girls want, I remember, wanting a pair of jeans and my mom telling me we couldn't afford them. But I think living through that made me go through a period when I was in college where I bought things that I had never been able to have before. which of course racked up my credit. And eventually I came to realize that even though I could have those things, they didn't really bring me the happiness that I thought they would.
There's a big line, I think, between need and want. Do I need a big screen TV or do I want a big screen TV? And if it's going to mean Tiffany not being able to go to yoga classes, then that makes no sense to me.
Honey, I'm so proud of you.
What a prince. And with that, we close chapter 2 of our financial fairy tale. Next time, who's footing the wedding bill? This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org.
Retirement planning sometimes resembles alphabet soup. IRA, SEPP. Maybe that's one reason why a relatively new option hasn't gotten much attention from employers. It's called a Roth 401k. Well, the Treasury Department recently issued some new rules to make it more attractive. And we've asked Liz Pulliam Weston from MSN Money to explain. So, Liz, what has changed?
The two big issues here had to do with whether an employee could consolidate one Roth 401k from your past employer and put it in with your new employer's plan. Treasury Department decided, yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
The second big issue was, what happens if the employee wants to take his or her own contributions out of the plan before they reach the magic age of 59 and a half? This is an issue because with a Roth IRA, which is what the Roth 401k was kind of based on,
right,
you can always take your contributions out. There's no penalty. There's no tax. What the Treasury Department decided with Roth 401ks is pretty much the same thing. You can still take your contributions out at any point, but you do have to pay tax on any gains that you've had in the meantime.
And is there a penalty that goes along with that as well?
I believe so. I think they were trying to get people to pay the 10% premature withdrawal penalty that they have to pay if they take money prematurely.
Okay. You and I have talked before about the Roth 401k, and you're a big fan of it. Remind us why that is and why it's so great for employees to take advantage of it. Hopefully, as more employers offer it.
To understand the benefits of a Roth 401k, you have to back up a bit and understand why a Roth IRA is such a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
With a Roth IRA, you put the money in and you don't get a tax deduction up front, but the money gets to grow over time. And when you take your money out in retirement, it's entirely tax-free. Add to that the fact that you don't have to take it out along any particular schedule.
Right.
With a Roth IRA, you get to take the money out on your own schedule or not take it out at all if you don't need it. You can just pass it along to your heirs tax-free.
So then why do we need a Roth 401k?
Well, a Roth 401k adds that benefit to the regular 401k. With a Roth 401k, again, you put the money in without the tax deduction, but the money comes out tax-free in retirement, and you take it out on your own schedule. Now, the problem with the Roth IRA was that there are income limits. With the Roth 401k, there are no income limits, so anybody can contribute it if their employer offers one.
And does the tax-free benefit apply as well to your employer's contributions?
No, unfortunately, your employer match does go into the pre-tax part of the plan.
All right, and so hopefully we'll be seeing more employers offer this, and your advice is certainly go ahead and take advantage of it.
Absolutely. I mean, my feeling is most people are going to be better off at least putting half their money in the Roth 401k.
All right, Liz Pulliam Weston, thanks again for coming in.
Anytime.
Liz is a personal finance expert for MSN Money. A trio of retirement accounts, or should you just go solo? Chris sings a financial tune in the mailbag. And speaking of singing,
I sing songs. I've done more dancing and singing than I had done since I was a child, probably, in the last 2 years.
A day in the work life of a stay-at-home mom. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. It's one of the most valuable jobs in the country, and it doesn't pay a thing. We're talking, of course, about being a stay-at-home parent. The experts at Salary.com did some research recently on what a mom's toil is worth. Ready for this? $138,000 a year. So on this Mother's Day edition of A Day in the Work Life, we visit a stay-at-home mom in her place of business.
Unlike my mother, who kept an immaculate house, I actually try and put off a lot of the daily household tasks until Zelda's asleep. I wouldn't give up goofing around with her just to do laundry or do the dishes.
Hi, my name is Shauna Eleni. I am 34 years old, and I am primarily a stay-at-home mother. My responsibilities on a day-to-day basis include, I suppose I'm a chef, a teacher, a housekeeper, a handyman, hopefully a role model, an entertainer for sure. I sing songs. I've done more dancing and singing than I had done since I was a child, probably, in the last 2 years. I have a fixed memory of walking through the neighborhood carrying her in a baby carrier, and she was requesting that I sing her Harry Belafonte songs. And so I'm walking through the neighborhood singing Harry Belafonte, and, you know, passerby was definitely turning heads, wondering, you know, really surprised to see me talking to myself with a little baby. Actually, her favorite was Matilda. She liked, Matilda, she take me money and run Venezuela. And so I'm, like, singing that, walking through the neighborhood, trying to entertain my then baby. I think being a stay-at-home mother is very different than it was in the 50s. First of all, the vocabulary has changed. In the 50s, stay-at-home mothers were called homemakers, and I think it was a much more important part of their job to keep the house spick and span and have dinner on the table when their husband came home from work, and a lot of these sort of more traditional ideas. Now, I think those of us who choose to stay at home, at least, you know, it's far more about being an excellent parent, and you try and, you know, serve the right kinds of foods and be a great role model in terms of activities and getting your child exercise and sleep and exposing them to all the things that will help them, you know, blossom into the most wonderful human being that you can help create. When you're doing the financial calculations of being a stay-at-home parent, I think you have to include the fact that the time I spend with her is, in essence, an investment in her future. Over time, hopefully, this will enable her to be, like, the kind of person who can really achieve her own goals. I mean, that's really what you're hoping for. I mean, you can talk about earning power. Hopefully, she'll increase her earning power by my time with her. But actually, mostly, I really hope that whatever she decides to do, that she'll know better how to achieve happiness and achieve her goals. I do plan to return to the paid workforce. I have a lot of experience now, you know, in non-paid work, and I'm hoping that the skills that I'm using will translate to a higher pay when I do return to work, for sure. People do sometimes make comments that really kind of, like, downplay my essential role as a caregiver because I'm a stay-at-home mom. But I have a wonderful time spending time with a 2-year-old, and I wouldn't trade it in for the world right now.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Francesca Segrig.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at nasdfoundation.org.
An internet arms race brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, channel bonding. Channel bonding is the latest development in the war between cable and telecom. They've been competing over who can give customers the fastest internet connection. This week, cable giant Comcast unleashed its ultimate weapon, channel bonding. It fuses 4 channels to transmit data fast. Comcast execs used it to download a 32-volume encyclopedia in under 4 minutes. But before consumers rejoice, cable execs admitted it won't be available for a couple of years, and they really don't know how much it'll cost. Ah, c'est la guerre.
Got a box full of letters, thinking my right to read.
I'm Tess Viglund, and what's a listener like you doing in a place like this? I know you're here to get your financial questions answered, of course. And our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here to help. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing, Tess?
I'm doing well, and you?
I am doing well.
Are you ready for lots and lots of questions?
I absolutely am. It's just my favorite part of the week.
Excellent. Mine too. But before we get to the answers, we'd like everyone to take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there. Or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right, let's go to call number one. We've got Evelyn from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi, Evelyn.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a 76-year-old widow. I'm a novice at investments, and I do have two adult children who do help me some, but they live outstate.
All right, well, what's your question for Chris today?
Well, the one question I had is I have a new financial advisor, and he is managing 3/4 of my account. Now, the new financial advisor wants to put about 50% in stocks in my trust and about 40% in the family trust. And I'm concerned because the large amount of stocks, it's mainly stock funds. And, of course, in the stock fund includes growth, value, and balance, of course. But he says that I shouldn't be concerned that it's too much because the large cap companies are usually stable companies with little turnover and low risk. And I guess I question that, especially with my age and all.
Yeah, Chris, you don't generally hear that people in their 70s are advised to have so much money in stocks.
Right. There's a couple things that are going on here. First of all, there's nothing wrong with large capitalization stock. Typically, your large capitalization stocks also pay a nice dividend. Now, I would dispute the statement that large cap stocks are less risky. Look, the nature of the beast, stocks are risky. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't have some of your portfolio in stocks. My real question, and I can't evaluate the whole situation, is are you well diversified? And what's the time horizon that you're investing in? Because if you're investing for yourself at 76, you're going to want to be very conservative and you're going to want to have a lot of income. You have two adult children. If you want to be investing with them partly in mind, you can add a little more risk to your portfolio. Overall, the question that I would come back with is a question about not whether something is less risky or more risky. Let's just look at what you want to be doing, what's your income, and what's your time horizon. If it's your time horizon, you go conservative. If it's your children's time horizon, you can be a little more aggressive.
When you talk about diversified, now all these stocks are in balanced or growth or, you know, it's a variety of stocks.
Right.
Is that what you mean by diversified?
No, what I mean by diversified is your 50% stocks.
Uh-huh.
That's a hefty chunk of your overall portfolio. Should it be 30%?
It should be.
Perhaps. I mean, 50% seems a lot to me.
Well, it did to me, too.
That's what all I'm saying. It seems a lot to me. You're 50% in stocks. Are you diversified enough? That's the question I'd keep pushing back on.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye.
All right. Why don't we reach into the email bag? We've got Nancy writing in from Bayside, Wisconsin. Chris, she is self-employed and has several retirement accounts. She's got a simple IRA, a Roth IRA, and a regular 401k from a prior job. But she wants to know if this is okay, or should she combine them? How many types of IRAs and 401ks can you contribute to in a single year? Is she going to get in trouble if she contributes too much to them? So what's the answer here?
First of all, she has a simple IRA, which is a retirement savings plan that was designed for small businesses. And then she has her Roth, so assuming she comes under the income limits, she's just absolutely fine there.
And you can find those income limits where, on the IRS website?
You can find them on the IRS website. You can go to your favorite mutual fund company.
Okay.
They all have it. You can go to TurboTax. The real question is the 401k from her previous employment.
Hmm.
I'm assuming, just the way that you read it, it's probably sitting at with her employer. And so I tend to say, you know what, take the 401k and put it into what we call a rollover IRA, because you can watch it and then you can manage it yourself. The only reason why you would not make that move is if your employer, and some employers do, just gives you great choices. Under that circumstance, keep it with your employer. But otherwise, I would roll it over into a rollover IRA. And by the way, next year in 2008, you will be able to go from a 401k rollover into a Roth IRA. Right now, it's a little bit like, what's this thing, Dances with the Stars? You have to do a two-step. You go from the 401k to a regular rollover IRA, then to the Roth. But, you know, that's for the future.
Well, maybe they'll choose to do a Tango instead. But the question here still, I think, is whether she's going to run into trouble if she fully contributes to all of these different retirement accounts that she has.
On that level, we're talking simple IRA and we're talking Roth IRA.
Okay.
And she'll contribute the maximum, which I believe is now $8,000 for the simple IRA. And then if she comes under the income limits, she can contribute to a Roth IRA to the maximum, which is $4,000.
So you can have all kinds of different accounts and you can contribute the max to all those different accounts.
Right.
All right. Well, retirement accounts certainly can be confusing, but they're also so important. So if you've got a question, please let us know about it. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Now let's go to caller number two. We've got Jake on the line from Middletown, Colorado. How you doing, Jake?
I'm doing pretty good, thank you.
What do you do there in Middletown?
I'm a system administrator for an advertising agency out here.
I understand that you're looking to get into a market that is increasing across the country, which is foreclosed homes. Why are you interested in this?
Well, I'm a first-time home buyer, so I don't have a whole lot of money to spend. And buying a foreclosed property, generally, it's a lot more affordable for me.
Mm-hmm. So have you found one that you like?
Yep, I have. I'm actually in the process of purchasing it.
All right. Well, what's your question for Chris today, then?
Well, my question was, in purchasing a foreclosure property, I mean, there's obviously, you know, one of the bigger things is you're buying this property under market value. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, what does that open me up to, you know, when next year rolls around and all of a sudden, you know, it appraises for $50,000 more than what I bought it from? And how can I protect myself from, you know, any problems that might occur?
Interesting. This is a unique situation in terms of home buying, isn't it, Chris?
It is. And, you know, quite frankly, if it was worth $50,000 more, I'd be dancing down the street.
Except for that, the property taxes that you might have to pay.
Right.
Hey, Tess, if you got a $50,000 gain in this market, you'll pay those extra taxes. If you get the property under market and you're able to make some improvements to it, and then when the market turns around, you sell it, it's going to be a good financial deal from you if it is truly under market. And as far as the property taxes go, there will be some catch-up going on there, but hopefully not too big a hit.
Is there anything that Jake has to worry about in terms of the fact that this was a foreclosed property? Is there any way that, I don't know, the previous bank with the previous owner could come after him for any amount of money? Or are there any fees that he's going to have to pay because this was a foreclosed property? Or is it really just like any other home purchase?
Oh, no. In general, with foreclosed properties, Tess, you raised a bunch of really important issues. For one thing, a lot of people moving into the foreclosure market. And therefore, I think that the bargains are less bargains. You do have to worry about hidden liens, a lien with the IRS, for example.
And that's not something that has to be disclosed to you?
No.
Wow.
It doesn't have to be disclosed to you. And let's say there are other debts that were secured by the home. You might end up, under certain circumstances, you could end up with those debts. So there are a lot of real problems. It sounds like, Jake, you don't have this problem, but in some foreclosures, angry people may be leaving. They leave it in not very nice conditions, or it may have really deteriorated. So there's a lot of information on the web, overwhelming amount of information about foreclosures. But what my cautionary notes are, local rules differ. Secondly, there's some really skilled people in that market, and typically novice investors tend to overpay. There are some hidden debts that you need to be wary of. And, you know, the notion that, and I don't think, Jake, you're doing this, but the notion you're going to put a couple thousand dollars down and make a couple hundred thousand dollars, you know, I think everybody should just abandon that notion. Markets are not that inefficient.
Yeah, I would agree.
All right, Jake, so it sounds like there are a few things to look out for, but so far you've done the right things in this process.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've already gone over with the bank and the real estate agent, you know, to see if there were any liens on the property or anything like that. And the property itself has been on the market since November of 2006. So, you know, I'm reasonably sure that there's not anything hidden on this one, but I'll definitely look into those.
Okay, well, thanks for the call.
By the way, I think it's what you've done. It's very smart. It sounds like you've done your work, you've done your homework, and hey, welcome to the world of home ownership.
Well, thank you very much.
Take care.
Thank you.
Got any sort of question you just can't seem to get an answer for? Well, give us a call and we'll try to help. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. How about one more reach into the email bag? You ready?
Yes.
Okay, we've got Doug writing in from White Oak, California. And he's got a friend who's got quite a bit of money on his credit cards. Doug found out that the cards that his friend has are charging him an enormous interest rate. In one case, almost 30%. So Doug thinks that this may violate some rules governing predatory interest rates. How in the world could credit cards charge such a high fee when the banks have limits? But Chris, I'm going to guess you're going to say the banks are fully within their rights to do this.
What limits? 30% is what we call the default rate. You're carrying a lot of debt. You miss some payments. They charge you the 30%.
Didn't we used to call that usury?
We did. And it's a legacy of the high inflation years. And so there was a federal law change. And so national banks, federally chartered savings banks, they could ignore state usury laws. So here's the real bottom line. There was a fight in Congress, now it did get passed, but payday loans for the military and their spouses was capped at 36%. All right, now this is outrageous. So if military and their spouses have a cap of 36% in their loans, we live in a world where there are no limits on what you can be charging people, essentially.
So my guess is that your advice here would be, A, start paying off some of those credit cards, and B, perhaps he could call the credit card company that's charging him the 30% interest rate and see if they'll bargain with him, or perhaps he just goes, transfers the balance to another card.
Well, the problem with it is that if you're truly hitting the 30% rate, you're probably not going to be able to transfer into that 0% card.
Because you're a credit risk.
Exactly. Yeah. So unfortunately, that's what's going to happen there. It does not hurt to call. The other thing you can do is go to a reputable consumer credit counseling service and sort of see whether or not they can get you on some sort of a debt repayment plan that may also help out. But you want to stick with consumer credit counseling services, nonprofits that are legitimate, and be wary of these mills that are out there that will charge you lots of fees and lots of money, and then they'll never even make the phone call to the bank to get the lower interest rate. It's outrageous, but unfortunately, it's the way of our world right now.
Unfortunately, that's for sure. Well, unfortunately as well, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But please do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. We spell that M-O-N-Y. Or visit the contact page on our website, marketplace.org. Thanks so much for all the terrific advice, Chris.
You're welcome.
Going global has its rewards, especially for our Seattle Investment Club.
They will allow Americans to buy common stock in Canada, France, Germany, Hong Kong, Japan, and the United Kingdom.
They're buzzing over foreign stocks. And stay-at-home moms, beware. A new book says you'd better take stock of your financial security. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Back now to our investment club series. We're following three clubs, one in Seattle, another in San Jose, and a third in Fairfax, Virginia, as they figure out what stocks to buy, sell, and hold throughout the year.
The stock didn't do very well.
What sectors do you buy?
Prices are going to continue to go up.
Join the club.
It's been a little more than 3 months since our last trip to Seattle. The Meridian Pacific Club has six members who meet once a week, this time not for coffee, but for beers at a German pub called Feierabend. Three of them showed up tonight, Nathan Bugia, who was here for our last visit, plus Mohit Srivastav and a thirsty Sumit Lohia. Yeah.
Please order a Francis Connor.
Uh-huh.
Thanks. When I was in Germany, I really enjoyed the beer. It just brings back old memories.
To refresh our memories, this club is a little different from the ones in San Jose and Virginia. They don't invest as a group. So I asked how their individual stock picks are doing.
This is Nathan. To be honest, I am up 3.5% for the year. Not a whole lot. I took 40% and invested it in a broad S&P index fund, 20% in an overseas investment, This year, I'm a little bit heavier in CDs and mutual funds because I want to be a little bit more conservative.
How about you?
This is Mohit. I invest for the most part long term. I have some play money I'll put in individual stocks. The third in international. I have about 25% still in Microsoft, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend. But that's just because I used to work there and I've held on. And it's also defense and aerospace.
So how's your return for the year so far?
It looks like it's in the 5-6% range since January 1st.
All right. Sumit?
This is Sumit. I think my return is closer to about, as Mo said, about closer to 6% or so. Overall, I think I want to play longer term into the market as opposed to this, you know, a 1 month or a six month window. I basically feel that the real estate market in Seattle is probably has the best return longer term. So most of my money is actually in certificate of deposits because I'm waiting to put down a down payment for a house instead. For the remaining investments, I do have some stock in Amazon because of having worked there.
It's been a busy time in the stock market since we last met with the Seattle Club. Sumit still has confidence in housing in spite of the subprime crisis. And none of them really flipped out over the big market dip in February, the one that started with a 9% drop on the exchange in Shanghai.
This is Nathan. Because I was so diversified, it didn't really impact me that much.
And you didn't actively move out of any stocks because of what happened?
I thought about it. I thought about it quite a lot, and I still think about it. But I forced myself to not do anything because I wanted to invest based on numbers, not based on emotion. It was not easy.
Honestly, I was a little bit was not fully paying attention to the market at the time. But I did catch some news reports, and the amount that the Shanghai market dropped that day compared to the gains in the last year, you know, was not that significant. So I didn't take my money out of the market. I just held on.
And how about you, Sumit?
Well, with Shanghai, as kind of Nate and Mo mentioned, I was a little concerned, obviously, the day off and then the day after as to what would happen to the market over here. But mostly I just stayed put.
Turns out that was exactly the right thing to do. Both the Dow and the Shanghai Index hit new records since then. And this club is exploring the possibility of even greater investments in overseas markets with a new tool coming out soon from an online trading company.
So just to set some context, we've been looking at investing in foreign companies for quite a while, actually a couple of years. And only Sandy has been really able to do that, being a Indian resident.
This is Mohit. If you are a U.S. citizen, there are two ways to invest internationally. The first way is through something called ADRs. Most of us have done that, so that's essentially a listing on the U.S. stock market for a foreign company. And the other way you can get into a foreign market is buying a mutual fund.
It was great news when E-Trade announced that they were going to release a global trading platform, which would allow Americans to buy common stock in Canada, France, Germany, Hong Kong, Japan, and the United Kingdom. So the cost of setting up an account, they'll have a new type of brokerage account for global trading. I read a couple articles, and they did highlight a few issues. When you're trading foreign companies, there's some additional tax liabilities. There's also data quality issues. It's much, much harder to find data on foreign companies, as we experienced with both Nintendo and Hyundai. And the accounting practices are not the same as they are in the U.S., so there's no Sarbanes-Oxley or SEC guidelines.
And this is something that's attractive to you because?
Well, I'm not necessarily ready to purchase foreign companies or stocks yet, but the fact that we have the opportunity to now allows us to explore more options.
Lots of the developing markets are growing really fast, but also they don't have a lot of the practices in place that we have in the U.S.
I think as Mohit mentioned, you know, I think there are ways that you can actually come out much better by investing in some of these markets. I wouldn't say put all your money, obviously, in one basket, but, you know, having a certain diversified portfolio definitely helps a lot.
Sound advice. We'll check in later in the year to find out if any of them decided to go for it on foreign exchanges. Next week, the women of our Virginia Club get ready to pour the bubbly as their investments cross the $100,000 mark. You'll find photos and links to all of our Investment Club segments at marketplace.org.
Market
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
So earlier we heard from a stay-at-home mom. She's perfectly happy, hoping to rejoin the workforce at some point. Well, now we're going to talk to the author of a controversial new book called The Feminine Mistake. Leslie Bennett argues that women who opt out of the workforce, or never join it in the first place, are putting their financial lives at enormous risk. Leslie, you say this is not about the mommy wars, but that's really how a good number of women see it. Why do you think it's such a big mistake for these women to stay home?
They're only assessing it at a particular moment in time. If you are 35 and you're home with your children, you might say, oh, it's worked out really well for me. But what about if you're 50 and your husband leaves you or dies or gets sick or incapacitated or loses his job and you're suddenly struggling to support your family? What you're likely to find if you try to go back into the workplace at a moment of crisis or need is that you can't get back in and get a decent job with benefits. This is a very unpleasant surprise for women who suddenly find that they do need to earn a living.
Does financial self-sufficiency then have to come from working, or can it also be part of how you are involved in managing the finances at home, whether you work or not?
Well, that depends on how many financial resources you have. I mean, if your husband is a billionaire and you've set up lots of provisions whereby if something happens to him, you're still going to be provided for, then, you know, there's no problem. If you don't want to work, you are not terribly vulnerable if you don't. But I find that most women have not really been that serious about financial planning. Again, this is what the data show. All the investment advisors and financial planners that I talked to said women have a tremendous tendency to leave these things to men. They may pay the household bills, but they don't really involve themselves with the larger financial planning of the family.
But if they were to get involved in that planning, wouldn't that serve to ameliorate the problem of not working?
Only if they have resources that are great enough to provide for their futures. But these days, women are routinely living into their 80s and 90s. And very few women realize that if something happens to their husbands when they're 50, they may have four decades or more to support themselves on whatever financial resources he left behind. The average age of widowhood in America is only 55.
The average age of widowhood is 55 years old?
According to the AARP, yes.
That's astonishing.
Yes, it is. And by the time women are in their early 60s, two-thirds of American women are without partners.
I wonder what your thoughts are on women who really believe and feel that it's what they want to do with their life to stay home and work with their children and raise their children. Because your argument really is that you have to, at some point, be a part of the workforce so that later on, if something, God forbid, happens, you are able to get a job and support your family.
I'm not saying it's not a valid choice to stay home with your children. I'm saying it's an extremely dangerous choice and one that works out very badly for many women and their kids. In my book, I say, was it really worth it to be home when your second child lost his fourth tooth if something happens to your husband and you end up losing your home entirely? I've talked to so many women who find themselves suddenly without a breadwinner, and a lot of the adverse consequences of divorce in the society are really a result of the economic impact. Women's standard of living plummets by 38% in cases of divorce, whereas men's standard of living goes up by 26%, but it's the women and the children who suffer. So I'm not criticizing the inherent worth or value of the decision to be home with your children, but I am saying it's a very risky choice.
Are there options for those women outside of going back to work?
Well, first of all, they have to do sensible financial planning within the context of the family, sit down with their husbands and make a plan for what's going to happen to the wife and the children if something happens to him. But second of all, if women are going to take timeouts from the workforce, there are ways that you can handle timeout to maximize your chances of getting back in. But again, I find a lot of women are not aware of that. I think that it's a big shock when women learn that as little as 3 years out of the workforce results in women taking a nearly 40% hit in their earnings. So when women do take time out, if they can target their volunteer work to areas that are relevant to their professional fields, that can help them later on. There are lots of things like that that people can do. But I find that many women simply retire to a domestic life and they think, oh, I don't have to think about this until I want to come back. They don't realize how quickly the ageism and sexism kick in, but they don't know this until after they're already up against it.
Leslie Bennett is the author of The Feminine Mistake. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And you can find a link to Leslie's book on our website, marketplace.org. While you're there, we're guessing you might have some thoughts about the book. Send them our way. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts
is
say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
it's like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help you sort out what's smart, what is stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, you and I hope by this time our beloved listeners know that a good credit score is a big deal.
That's right.
Which explains why the credit repair business is really booming. You know, all over TV and the internet, you'll find ads like this one.
We can effectively raise your credit score. Imagine the savings you will realize from a better credit rating. You'll have the ability to get loans at a lower interest rate. You'll be able to get approved for credit cards, a new phone, a car. Insurance
and a unicorn. Yeah. Anyway, you know, this week the courts weighed in against the credit repair business. You want to tell us about this?
Well, there's this proposed settlement test to a class action lawsuit. And just boiling it down, the agreement would put limits on businesses claiming that they can raise people's credit profile, which, as you said, that's what we all want, right? Mm. And among the people that would change your pitch is Susie Orman, the personal finance guru.
Hmm.
Now, she sells a credit repair system called Susie Orman's FICO Kit. And FICO is the big kahuna of credit scoring.
And we should say that's the Fair Isaac Corporation, FICO.
That's right. But according to the New York Times, with this settlement, she's already soft-pedaling the product's promotion. Still, the real problem, Tess, isn't with Susie. In fact, it's a good product. It's with the many credit repair companies. Here's the straight story. It's tempting to hire one of these companies to clean up your report, but this is one of those times when it pays to save your money and do it yourself.
All right, let's talk briefly about this lawsuit. What was involved here?
Okay, what it is, there's a law called the Credit Repair Organizations Act, which was an attempt to control the fly-by-night outfits, because the Federal Trade Commission, they say they have all kinds of problems with these credit repair companies. They're kind of like cockroaches. You know, you stamp down one, plenty more come up. And, you know, they used to be for-profit, now they're non-profit. I'm not saying there aren't some legitimate ones, because there are some legitimate ones, but it's also an area ripe for scams. So there was this lawsuit, and what it said is, look, you can't use these terms like improving, enhancing, boosting, and pair them with words like tips, suggestions, advice. What they're trying to do is lower people's expectations and say, look, you know, if you work with one of these companies, it may not improve your credit score depending on what can really be done.
Well, then what can credit repair companies advertise? What can they say they can do for you?
Well, what they can do for you is anything that you can do yourself.
Uh-huh.
So you can look at the credit report and you can challenge something that you don't like or you think that is wrong. I mean, this is really the bottom line. There's nothing that they can do that you can't do yourself. And by the way, can I toss in one other thing, Tess?
I suppose.
In order to find a legitimate credit repair company, you have to do a lot of research. Contact the Better Business Bureau. Get referrals. Maybe contact the Federal Trade Commission. I mean, by the time you do all that research, you just might as well just do it yourself.
Well, let's take people through some of the things that they can do by themselves without going through one of these credit repair businesses to help boost their own credit scores.
First thing you do is you can get for free once a year from the three major credit reporting bureaus your credit report. That's the first step. And if there's something on there that you can challenge or something that's wrong, you then move to an old-fashioned world. We're going to take a step back in time. Snail mail. Initially, if you're going to be challenging something, if you like something removed, if you think something's wrong, you do it by mail so that you build a file. And then you start paying your bills on time, basic personal finance. And with time, if there are some issues where you went through a divorce or you lost your job or there were some healthcare problems, and the fact of the matter is, you know, look, you did miss some bills. So what? It happens to all of us. Those things become less and less important as your current history shows that you're responsible with your credit and you're responsible with your bills.
All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, extra credit for you for such great advice today.
I like extra credit. Thank you.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, $28,000 for one trip down the aisle.
The bridal industry is encouraging brides, if they don't spend as much money as they possibly can on this day, that their married life will not be as happy and fulfilling as it might be.
Oh, my goodness. Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes with Rico Galliano, Nancy Fargali, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
American Public Media.